I cannot read the mind of the court below and tell you why they dismissed this case. But I can tell you that Rule 56 requires the court to explain its reasoning. There was no reasonable explanation given. The court below did not give Tate a fair hearing. When the court listed the facts that it deemed material in this case, it did not list a single substantive fact as documented by the plaintiff. Not one. The facts set forth by the court can be summarized as follows. First, a plain vanilla paragraph identifying the plaintiff and the Doors defendants. Second, a long paragraph devoted to Addis, which can best be described as praising Addis. And
Forgive me, I'm going to stop you there because I would be very interested to know what your best evidence is for imposing. It's just a love note. Don't worry about it. Man's crazy about me. Okay. Would it be Mr. Humphrey's statement that Mr. Tate wasn't going to be around much longer?
That statement closes the loop on the conspiracy, is the way I would put it. Yes, this case has some direct evidence and a mosaic of bits and pieces of evidence as well. And then the most substantial direct evidence is that statement by Humphrey and the document from Farmer to Standiford, the email in which Farmer outlines the plan to retaliate and to get rid of Tate's staff and to blame Tate for the accusations against him, which is in that email that Farmer wrote to Standiford. So I would say those two are the direct evidence, the most compelling.
Is plaintiff still working for the department?
Excuse me, Tate, you mean?
Yes.
Yes, Tate is still working for the department. He was suspended three times. He filed this lawsuit. Since
right.
that time, the people who supervised him have left, and he's still there.
But in terms of this closing the door on the conspiracy that he won't be around much longer, in fact, he is still there, right?
Yes, but this was a statement before the fact, not with hindsight. Mm-hmm. I think the intention, the way she said it, he's done some bad things, and he's not going to be around much longer. We're going to make sure of it. That is not a statement that it's going to happen. That's a statement of a plan that it should happen. The plan got derailed, for example, by the fact that we filed a lawsuit, which made them more careful about their plan. And soon after that, Ansel left that Ansel wasn't his supervisor anymore, and things got better. So I do want to point out to you how I just think it's important to point out how how little the court recognized of the plaintiff's case. So let me just skip to the one statement I wanted to say. Here's the from the fact section that the court gave in the below. They have only three sentences about the plaintiff's case, and I'll quote them for you exactly. In November or December 2003, Green complained that Farmer had sexually harassed her. Tate claims that he encouraged her to file an EEOC complaint against Farmer. In December 2003, Vicki Tuttle, another employee, filed an EEOC charge alleging that Farmer sexually harassed her. That's the extent of that's plaintiff's entire prima facie case, according to the court below. No wonder they found summary judgment for the defendants. They didn't have any of the plaintiff's facts or case.
Well, you know, the notion that there was a conspiracy to isolate and ultimately get rid of Mr. Tate is obviously a very big part of your case. But Judge Herndon said that the conspiracy theory rested on, I think he said, hearsay and speculation. So tell us how he was wrong on that.
He didn't identify, I'm not even sure I remember the line, but if he said that, he didn't identify the hearsay and speculation. So what in here is hearsay? First of all, there was no objection to the hearsay, so the plaintiff had no notice that he to give an answer to any allegations of hearsay. I still have no notice of what statement is alleged to be hearsay, so I don't know what statement I should defend against. I'm willing to conjecture something. The statement by Humphrey that we just talked about, well, that could be construed as hearsay against when used against Ansell, because it's an admission by Humphrey, but it's not an admission by Ansell. And so but we are claiming conspiracy exception to the hearsay rule because we have numerous other facts that show that Humphrey acted as an instrument of Ansell's desire to punish Tate. She spied on Tate, she gave four false witness against Tate, and so forth, which the plaintiff has documented when you take the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. So we think the hearsay, the conspiracy exception to the hearsay rule would apply to that. Beyond that, I don't know what else is hearsay here that we're talking about.
Let's talk about the ADA claim for a moment, if we might. One of the points that Judge Hearn made was that Mr. Tate had never discussed the sleep apnea with anyone other than his former supervisor. Is there contrary evidence, for example, that Ansell was aware of his disorder and yet somehow refused an accommodation?
It depends on when you say aware, let me answer in two levels. There's two things I want to say about that. First of all, I believe the institution can be held responsible when the institution orders him to have a doctor study, which he does, and presents the report to the institution. So that the fact that his former supervisor knew this should be imputed to the institution, and the institution has no reason to assume that the sleep apnea suddenly stopped after she stopped being his supervisor. Now, the second point I would make is that as soon as he got this, and I would add that Tate had every reason, it was reasonable before the charges were made against him for Tate to assume that the institution knew that he was doing the informal accommodations that his former supervisor had recommended. She recommended that he just have his secretary sit with him and poke him if he started to fall asleep, and she was happy with that, the former supervisor, and that was fine with Tate. So he thought that was still valid.
Now, the district court did, as I recall, note certain facts about the sleeping disorder. His failure to list the sleeping disorder on his emergency medical card, the fact that he didn't use a sleeping apparatus at night, and I believe he described the sleep apnea that he suffered from as being minor.
Well, there's no evidence that it's minor, and if there were, this is a question of fact. We should go to the doctor's report.
The evidence comes from his mouth.
No, it came. He took it from the supervisor who said it was minor in her affidavit, meaning that it was minor after the accommodation. She wasn't worried about it anymore. And the judge interpreted it to mean it was minor before the accommodation. That's a very different, and I shouldn't have said no so authoritatively. Maybe I missed something, but my understanding is that's where he took it from, is from the supervisor's statement that it was minor, which was a statement made with respect to what happened after the accommodation. It was no longer a major problem. We don't want to make this a catch-22, this ADA report, that if you accommodate it, then it's minor, so now it's not a problem anymore. That would seem to defeat the whole purpose of the law. And I also wanted to tell you that as soon as he was charged with misconduct for falling asleep, he didn't remind his supervisors that he had a problem, and that he had a history of dealing with this problem, and this is how he did it, and they ignored his rebuttal.
I thought there was a wasn't he provided an accommodation in 2007? Didn't he ask for an accommodation?
There may have eventually been an accommodation kind of outside the it may have been right before we filed this lawsuit or right after we filed this lawsuit.
Part of the accommodation was to provide him a driver. Is that right?
As far as I know, Your Honor, they never provided him with a driver. I don't know where that comes from.
Well, I'll be curious to hear. I thought I was told that he had a driver and he hired his son as his driver.
I read that, Your Honor, and I've never investigated, and I don't know where that fact came from, but I'm not just going to say it's false. He may have briefly hired his son as a driver, but as far as I know, to this day, he's still not having a driver. He drives himself. That's my understanding.
Given all the concerns about nepotism that the plaintiff has raised, I just was struck by that.
I would agree, Your Honor, if that were a fact, and I just don't know that it's a fact.
Okay.
And I wouldn't believe that Ms. Ansell would have missed it, since she charged everyone else with nepotism, including Tate, on another occasion when it was wrong.
You know, you're in your rebuttal.
Oh. Well, if Your Honors have an important question you want to ask me, feel free. Otherwise, I'll save the rest of the time.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
So now, Ms. Welsh.
Good morning, Ms. Welsh.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Mary Welsh. I'm here on behalf of the State Defendants, and Ms. Kudin will be speaking later on behalf of the Addis Defendants. To answer Judge Hamilton's question first, on page 17 of document 89-1, which is Ms. Ansell's affidavit, she says there that that his son was hired as the driver.
Thank you.
Needless to say, we're here in support of the district court's judgment in favor of the state defendants. Plaintiff didn't really present any evidence to create a material question of fact on any of his claims. With regard to the court's concern about the ADA claim first, I might mention that plaintiff didn't, in his reply brief, counter any of the state defendants' arguments about the lack of evidence of this. And really the central question here is, did he present evidence that that his sleep apnea was a disability within the meaning of the ADA? And the answer to that is no.
Well, Mr. Tate didn't just have difficulty sleeping. He also had a history of nodding off at meetings and while driving. So why isn't that connection between his disorder and his performance at work not enough to create a material dispute of fact as to whether he was a qualified individual with a disability?
Well, there's no evidence that any of these defendants actually knew that. Remember, the only evidence is that Ms. Young,
his
previous supervisor, you know, noticed that he was, or heard, I don't know, that he was falling asleep, suggested to him that he get tested. He wasn't ordered. She suggested that he get tested for sleep apnea. He did. Those test results did not reveal that he had a major impediment to, you know, to sleeping, the life activity of sleeping. So they didn't rise to that level. And he said later on that he had difficulty with driving, that he was falling asleep driving, but there's no evidence that he ever told any defendant here. And it's important to note that no defendant either knew or even perceived of him as having a disability within the meaning of the ADA.
The supervisor did, because
she thought it was
informally
minor.
Accommodated him by having his assistant nudge him awake.
Right, but she says, I thought that this was a minor problem and this is how I dealt with it. It's not, as the plaintiff's counsel just said, that she thought it was minor after the accommodation. She thought it was minor before the accommodation. Remember, plaintiff never, ever, ever asked for an accommodation. And in fact, when he came back from his suspension for sleeping twice within a month at meeting trainings, you know, Ansell said to him, so is there a problem? Do you need to do anything? And he said, no, I'm good. Or I'm fine. I'm paraphrasing here. So, in fact, he never told any defendant until after he, you know, started his EEOC proceedings and so on, that he, in fact, had a problem that he perceived to be a disability within the ADA meaning, the meaning of the ADA, and that he needed an accommodation to perform his job. So, but I think the central focus of plaintiff's you know, complaint is his discrimination and retaliation claims. And plaintiff faults the district court for what he seems to perceive as the smoking gun, which is Ms. Humphreys' statement that we are going to get Tate because he did bad things. Well, perhaps the most important thing about this statement is that it was made after he filed his complaint. So it was made years after the events at issue here, which are the 06-07 suspensions. So that's and we have no idea what this means. Does it? Who are we? What are the bad things? When did those bad things happen? We just don't know. And plaintiff wants to say, well, I've decided that it must mean that it's us as Ansel and the Addis defendants, and the bad things are what he did in 2003 when he helped Ms. Tuttle file the discrimination charge against Farmer. Well, that doesn't make any sense. People don't wait 5 years. I mean, certainly no reasonable jury could find that an employer waited 5 years to come up with, you know, to retaliate against someone for helping a coworker make a complaint about sexual discrimination. And in fact, you know, all we have is we also have the email that plaintiff's counsel talked about, which was the email from from Farmer in early 2004, and remember he was suspended in 2006 and 2007. So plaintiff was suspended in 2006 and 2007. So this is two and three years before the events at issue here, the suspensions at issue here. And Farmer said to Sandifer in this email, you know, Tate is instigating, you know, dissension and so on within the ranks. He's not disrespectful. And this other woman, Ms. Sadler, is a pathological liar and she needs to go. Well, you know, she didn't actually, and nothing happened. This was in early 2003. Farmer remained there through, early 2004. Farmer remained as the supervisor through to December of 2004, and nothing happened. Nothing happened. There was some, you shouldn't be wearing, Mr. Tate, you shouldn't be wearing sandals to work, and there were some little, you know, picayune things of that nature, but certainly not anything that would rise to a discrete act of discrimination or an act of retaliation, or certainly not anything pervasive or severe enough to be a hostile work environment. So, with regard to the, you know, also focusing on the retaliation, there's really, you know, we have to keep in mind that you have to, Prelli really was obliged to present sufficient facts to show that a reasonable jury could find from those facts that Ansel, Standifer, Davis, who was the, you know, the assistant to Secretary Adams, and Farmer, all discriminated against him on the basis of his race or national origin and retaliated against him for his assistance with Ms. Tuttle's complaint about Ms. Green. Well, the problem with the retaliation claim, well, first of all, Farmer. You know, Farmer left in 2004. The suspensions happened in 2006 and 2007. Any claim against Farmer arising from Farmer's conduct is certainly untimely because either the statute of limitations for a 14th Amendment claim or the time bar for a Title VII claim is in 2006. And so that the time bar for those claims is at least a year, year and a half, depending on which claim, after Farmer left. So plaintiff has no evidence that Farmer did anything after that, that he even spoke to any of the other defendants after that. So with regard to Mr. Davis, there's no evidence that Mr. Davis did anything here with regard to the suspensions, and there's no evidence that he had no role that plaintiff has presented any evidence about that Mr. Davis had any with regard to the suspensions. And similarly, which are either retaliatory or discriminatory, it doesn't matter because Mr. Davis was completely uninvolved in those, according to the evidence that plaintiff presented. In addition, plaintiff really, the suspensions were, you know, plaintiff had to show that the suspensions were not, that other people committed similar offenses to, you know, to be successful in his complaint, his discrimination claim. Other people, co-workers, committed similar offenses. Well, none of his co-workers committed similar offenses for which they weren't suspended. He talks about Mr. Jones several years later, crashing, you know, uploading a bunch of music and crashing the server. Well, that has nothing, that's nothing to do with the sort of things that plaintiff did. Remember, what plaintiff did was that he did not follow the instructions about putting in summaries of evidence for various clients who were being reassessed. And he did this innumerable times. He also did other things for which he had received an oral reprimand. But primarily, he was suspended for two different things, two different sorts of conduct. The primary one was his inability to submit timely summaries of evidence repeatedly. That was the first suspension that was originally 5 days and came down to two. And then the second suspension, approximately 6 months to a year later, when he was suspended again for the very same thing. He didn't submit timely summaries of evidence. That was his responsibility, not anybody else's, and he just didn't do it. He doesn't have anybody, and he says, I don't know anybody else who did what I did. And unless, I don't want to eat into my co-counsel's time, unless the court has questions, we ask that the court affirm the judgment against plaintiff and for the state defendants.
Did you have one last thought that you wanted to set forth?
Well, I did. I have to say, I did want, it's really about the comparables, I think, in that he just, you know, with regard to the suspension for sleeping, you know, with regard to Mr. Bracewell, he had slept only once. Plaintiff slept twice within 1 month. Everybody agreed. There was no dissension. And with regard to Bracewell, there was ambiguity, not ambiguity. There was uncertainty because some people said yes, some people said I didn't see him. So needless to say, his discipline was different because his situation was different. Thank you.
Ms. Gooden. Morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Carmen Cowden, and together with my colleague Bernard Bobber, I'm here representing the Addis defendants in this matter. Mr. Tate's counsel claims that this is a complicated case, and that it's a case that involves a conspiracy that runs from events in 2003 all the way up through 2007. And in actuality, in all the way up through events in 2008, if you include the statement that he references made by Ms. Humphrey's ex-husband about what she said. But at the bottom of this case, it's really just a simple employment discrimination case. And it's an employment discrimination case about an individual who was suspended for violating his employer's work rules. And his employer was the state, was DRS, not Addis. In this case, there isn't any dispute that the Addis defendants did not make any of the decisions to suspend Mr. Tate. There's not any dispute that they weren't involved in making any recommendations about suspending Mr. Tate. In fact, the record shows that the Addis defendants weren't even aware of the suspensions until after Mr. Tate filed his lawsuit. In the absence of any of this evidence about the Addis defendants' participation in the actual adverse employment actions at issue, Mr. Tate tries to bring the Addis defendants into this via his conspiracy theory. As we've already discussed, Mr. Tate's theory requires an awful lot of inferences to be made in order to get to the point where one could conclude that any of the Addis defendants had any kind of retaliatory motive or had any kind of discriminatory motive or had in any way agreed to participate in any kind of conspiracy based on such motives. For instance, we've talked a little bit about the Humphrey statement. All Ms. Humphrey's alleged statement says is that in 2008, after the events at issue, Mr. Tate might not be around much longer because he's done some bad things. There's no explanation of what the bad things refer to, and as my co-counsel indicated, Mr. Tate wants you to assume that those bad things must mean his participation or his support for his co-worker's 2003 EEOC charge. But there's nothing in the alleged statement to support that. The court would actually have to speculate to reach that conclusion. Beyond that alleged statement, there's not really much that Mr. Tate offers up in support of his conspiracy theory, at least in terms of things that the Addis defendants were involved in. The majority of his argument and his facts relate to the various state defendants and how their alleged unlawful motivation led up to the suspensions.
Ms. Cowden, how did this contract work between the state and Addis? Were the Addis employees essentially working side by side?
They were.
With the state employees?
They were, Judge. They were in the same locations. They were filling slightly different roles. They did not have necessarily exactly the same roles as the state defendants. In a lot of cases, they were providing administrative support type roles or ancillary roles to the counselors that were in the DRS offices.
Could you address this question about the late summaries of evidence being provided for disputes over benefits, what Mr. Tate's role was and what Ms. Humphrey's role was in that?
I'm actually not sure that I'm the best person to address that, given
no,
that
you're the only person I can ask right now.
I understand. As I understand it, just based upon a review of the record and what I understand the state defendants to be saying about the requirements in that case, Mr. Tate, as the counselor responsible for...
I understand his responsibilities. What was Humphrey's role?
With respect to the one summary of evidence at issue, the one that she was actually involved in, she was to basically provide... assistance information about the case to Mr. Tate to help him in formulating that summary of evidence. Because she had done some summary of evidences in different cases to which she was assigned, Ms. Ansel asked Mr. Tate to work with her on the particular one he was supposed to prepare.
Thank you.
I guess the time goes fast when you're having fun, I guess.
If you have a final thought, I'll accept that.
I do not. I think we can rest in our briefs, Judge, unless the court has any more questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, I gave each of the appellees an extra minute, so would you add those 2 minutes to Mr. Fetter's time, please?
I would like to start by addressing a couple points that are wrong. There's no evidence in the record that this statement made by Humphrey was made in 2008. I don't know where the counsels got this.
So where
the affidavit was written in 2008.
It's your evidence. Where did it come from?
It came from Tom Hammonds and John Thomas Hammonds. One of them is the son of Ms. Humphrey, okay. And one of them is her ex-husband.
So when was
And
it
they
said?
Said, they. I don't believe they gave me a date, but they told Tate about this before the lawsuit was filed. That was one of the central facts that had us file the lawsuit. So the statement was made much earlier. The affidavits were not given until after we filed the lawsuit.
But the record is silent as to when it was made?
There's no record on the exact date when the statement was
made. How about the year?
I believe there's no record on the year. I believe I didn't ask them a date. But I couldn't swear to that without reading the affidavit again.
Do you know where the affidavit is in the record? We could.
I didn't bring the document numbers, but at the back of my reply brief, there's a list. At the end, in the appendix, there's a list of what all the document numbers are. It should be that right there. Pretty handy.
Are Humphrey and Kohler legitimate employees to compare with Mr. Tate if they work for Addis rather than the state?
Yes, I believe they are, and I understand this is a subtle question, but the fact is we don't emphasize form over substance. These two employees were given full rights. They had exactly the same duties as a counselor because Ms. Ansell gave them what's called flagging rights. Now, flagging rights gave them the right to make the final decision. The ordinary job is to assist the counselor, and the counselor makes the final decision, like signing off on the client's needs and how they're going to be accommodated. But for the two special case managers, and they were the only two that got these, Kohler and Humphrey, they were given flagging rights so they could make all the decisions themselves, and they didn't. Kohler was technically in Tate's office. Humphrey was not. But Kohler did not have to consult Tate before signing off on a patient, on a client. And she went out and did a case study just like Tate did. She had essentially the exact, and of course she was Evan's sister, as you know.
Presumably the Kohler and Tate, or Kohler and Humphreys would not have had, for example, the kind of civil service protections that Tate would have.
They wouldn't have the same civil service protections, and they didn't have the same training, a master's degree, that Tate had.
Okay.
I'd like to correct a couple other things. I just want to cite a case for you. Ganoski versus City of Chicago, 7th Circuit, 2012. If defendant was part of a conspiracy, he can be held liable for later actions by his co-conspirators. That applies to the statement about Farmer, that he can't be held liable if he initiated this conspiracy. I believe he can, under the Seventh Circuit law. Now, they said there was no evidence given that Ansell had any knowledge about his inability to drive, Tate's inability to drive, or that he would not off when driving. Well, she ordered, by her own testimony, which I haven't been able to verify, she ordered a driver. The counsel just read that. Why would she order a driver if she didn't know there was any problem about driving? I don't believe the statements are compatible. I'd like to quickly go back and talk about this, the conspiracy theory and how it evolved.
You don't have much time to do that.
Farmer was afraid. There were three charges. How much time do I have? A minute?
Well,
let me just start. I'll just tell you as much. Farmer was afraid. Oh, I'm sorry. Do you have a question? I misunderstood.
No, I don't have a question. I just wanted to know that your light is on. It's red and it's finished.
I'm sorry. I see. Thank you, Your Honors. I do understand.
So, because all these nice people are waiting to get out in the sunshine.
I apologize.
Thank you very much. No. Thank you so much. The case will be taken under advisement. And